Two examples, two models. One of Palestinians who are suffering, lacking clean water, lacking food, lacking life-saving medications in Gaza, and those who are being somewhat propped up and living slightly better life in a different model in the West Bank. Well, both models have now failed. The resistance in Gaza, the continued resistance, the strength of the Palestinians in Gaza shows that their spread has not been broken by the siege after all these years.
Sorry, I got to jump in.
And the rising resistance.
I got to jump in. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I'm so sorry. I do apologize for that. But it was great to see you. Ramzi Baruth, historian and author, spoke to us from Seattle, Washington. Thank you. Saad Nimr, thank you so much. Professor of Political Science at Brzezinski University from Occupied Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Gunman kills at least 9 people and wounds 7 others at a busy mall north of Dallas in the U.S. state of Texas. An Israeli settler shoots dead a Palestinian teenager near Afula, hours after regime forces killed 2 young men in a raid on a refugee camp in Tulkarem. Plus, people once again rally in Tel Aviv to protest against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Benis. Thanks for joining us. There's been another mass shooting in the U.S. At least 9 people have been killed and 7 others injured by a gunman at a busy mall in Dallas, Texas. The gunman, whom authorities said they believe acted alone, was also killed by the police. To get more details on how the shooting played out, we were earlier joined by our Washington correspondent, Colin Campbell.
Police arrived on the scene at about 6:15 local time because they were answering another call. When they heard the shots ring out, they responded with gunfire, killing the gunman after shots had already been fired. They responded fairly quickly. Several people who were killed. And this happened in Allen, Texas, about 50 kilometers from Dallas. It's about 50 kilometers north of Dallas. And of course, this is not the first time we've seen gun violence happen in Texas. With a very relaxed carrying policy, there were a lot of predictions that we would see gun violence in Texas. And this just happens to be one of the latest incidents as the U.S. climbs towards 200 in the number of mass shootings since the beginning of the year. Highest incidences of mass shootings since the beginning of the year in the past several years. And we've seen a different number of gun policies change where they've become more relaxed, not just states like Texas, but also in Florida and other states where they have open carry laws or permitless carry laws. And this means that people have easier access to guns. They can carry their guns in the open. They don't have to apply for a permit necessarily. And of course, this just makes the situation where people resort to using a gun for a means of conflict resolution or any type of dispute resolution, it's a lot easier to access that gun because the laws are a lot easier on gun owners and their access to them.
Thank you.
There are worrying signs in the U.S. that the banks in the country are not on solid footing. U.S. bank failures are happening on a more frequent basis, raising concerns among depositors and investors. And once again, the specter of another financial crisis is raised amongst economists and investors.
The sounding bell at the U.S. stock market, symbolic of a stock market that should be performing well. But these cheers are not reflective of what is going on in the U.S. economy. Instead, warning signs should be going off due to the U.S. banking sector. Trading was halted in shares of two more U.S. lenders. Regulators had to step in after PacWest and Western Alliance shares plunged. Although there was optimism in Wall Street after stocks, like in the banking sector, jumped Friday, following a good jobs report and strong Apple earnings, there were still fears and worries about the sector, the failure of four mid-sized banks since early March. Bank customers and investors feared a repeat of other bank failures in the U.S., like First Republic, SVB, and Signature. And those fears are justified. As many as 16 mid-sized banks have shed more than $57 billion in market value since last Friday. American regulators seized then-sold First Republic Bank to J.P. Morgan Chase on Monday, marking the second-largest ever U.S. bank collapse and the third major bank shutdown nationwide in the past 2 months, following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, and Signature Bank.
Today, the Federal Reserve issued its long-awaited report on the cause of the Silicon Valley Bank failure. And while it put the failure squarely in the hands of management and its board for failing to oversee a safe and sound business plan, the Fed did put some heat on itself that its own bank regulators did not respond quickly enough and forcefully enough to conditions on the ground, and these conditions also are conditions that First Republic faced.
The question that is being raised once again is, are we witnessing a repeat of the U.S. financial crisis? Since 2001, more than 500 banks across the U.S. have closed. Most happened after the 2008 financial crisis. Of all the banks that closed since 2001, the largest was Washington Mutual, which closed in September 2008, during the early stages of the financial crisis. The closure of First Republic is the second largest bank closure in the U.S. and the largest since the end of the financial crisis. But this is what stands out for those that believe that there is another financial crisis in the making. About 70 banks across the U.S. have closed over the past decade. The total assets of the three banks closed this year has exceeded the total assets of the 25 banks that closed in 2008, meaning that the scale of U.S. bank closures in 2023 is the largest in years.
In this case, you had a group of banks here that did not plan well for interest rate risk. They did not plan well for big growth, explosive growth. They didn't plan for what they should be planning for, and that's a liquidity event where you have more than ordinary numbers of withdrawals, especially given their levels of uninsured deposits. That's a problem. And so, you know, the chickens have kind of come home to roost for all of these banks.
As seen here, the three banks, namely First Republic, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, held a total of $532 billion in assets. That is more than the $526 billion, when adjusted for inflation, held by the 25 banks that collapsed in 2008, at the height of the global financial crisis.
Well, the issue of banks failing could be a symptom of the broader U.S. economy. Washington is facing challenges on a number of fronts. Inflation has remained untamable, while the debt ceiling is yet to be resolved, with the deadline being June 1, when the U.S. government may shut down.
There are major factors that are affecting the health of U.S. banks. One of them are the recent Fed hikes. In March of this year, a study jointly released by economists from multiple universities in the U.S. showed that the Fed's rate hike greatly increased the vulnerability of the U.S. banking system.
Fed, just as they were stubborn and obstinate on the idea that inflation was transitory, they're being stubborn and obstinate on the idea that they need to hit 2% inflation before they let up on the tightening. And that's simply just history doesn't bear it out. And unless and until they come to that realization by studying history, you're going to see more and more of these situations.
Affected by the Federal Reserve's aggressive interest rate hikes, the value of financial assets like bonds held by many U.S. banks has shrunk sharply, and the asset value of some banks has even decreased by more than 20%. According to the study, if market confidence continues to weaken and more depositors withdraw their deposits, as many as 186 banks may become insolvent and face the risk of closure. That should be a major concern for the Fed and the man on top, the U.S. President Joe Biden. Another item of concern for the U.S. administration is the U.S. debt ceiling. As it stands, the Biden administration remains at odds with Republicans who have refused to increase the debt ceiling.
Our MAGA Republicans in Congress are threatening to do all this progress by letting us, quote, default on the debt unless we agree to their demands. The two are totally unrelated. Whether you pay the debt or not doesn't have a damn thing to do with what your budget is. What your budget is. Where are you going to spend money? How are you going to raise the money? What are you going to cut? What are you going to... They're two separate issues.
If the debt ceiling, which has reached its peak of $31.4 trillion, is not raised, that could potentially lead to a government shutdown on June 1st. The U.S. government reaction so far, in terms of an intervention, has been subdued. She says even though U.S. banks are failing, it is reported that U.S. authorities are unlikely to intervene. The reason given, regional lenders such as PacWest and Western Alliance are not seen as systemically important, and more consolidation is predicted to be ahead. The outlook, however, looks bleak. Unless the Fed rides to the rescue with cuts in interest rates, the options are amalgamation, regulation, or more banks going bust. The response of the U.S. authorities suggests little appetite for a laissez-faire approach. While the U.S. is struggling with these economic issues, it is also facing the prospects of de-dollarization, which is uncontrollable since many countries are queuing up to wean their economy off the dollar.
Iran's president condemns the U.S.'s military presence in Syria, saying that it is doomed to fail. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in an interview with Syria's official news agency, Sana'a. He said that Syria will foil a U.S. plan to occupy parts of the Arab country to plunder its wealth. Raisi noted that no foreign military force should be present on Syrian soil, adding that the main concern of the regional countries is the restoration of Syria's sovereignty. The Iranian president returned to Tehran on Friday after a two-day trip to Damascus. Iran has executed the ringleader of a separatist group responsible for several terrorist operations in the country. Habib Farajullah Chab pleaded guilty in court after he was captured in 2020. Kisumi Shahmedi has the details.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian. We are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today, I came here to send a message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Israeli regime continues with its atrocities against Palestinians. An Israeli settler has shot dead a Palestinian teenager near the city of Afula. 19-year-old Diyar Omari succumbed to his wounds shortly after he was shot. No additional details are available about the incident. Earlier on Saturday, a funeral procession was held for two young Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during a raid on a refugee camp near the city of Tulkarm in the occupied West Bank. The two Palestinians were in their 20s. The latest Israeli violence brings the total number of Palestinians killed by the regime in the occupied West Bank area this year to 111. Around 20 of the victims are under 18 years old. Saturday's killings come amid rising tensions in the occupied territories, where Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians. Meanwhile, Palestinians in Gaza expressed anger over the extrajudicial assassination of three men and a woman in the West Bank city of Nablus. Ola Al-Assi reports from Gaza.
A vigil was held in Gaza denouncing the latest Israeli crimes in Nablus, which led to the killing of three Palestinian men and a woman. Israeli occupation forces raided Nablus city on Thursday morning and assassinated three freedom fighters. Israeli army claims that the victims are responsible for the resistance operation in the Jordan Valley last month. People from all walks of life in the besieged Gaza city came out in solidarity with the West Bank against the Israeli regime's atrocities, confirming their utter support for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank.
Those who were killed by the Israeli occupation were defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and killing them in cold blood is a war crime committed by the Zionist criminals. These crimes would only increase the Palestinian resistance actions and strengthen their unity against the occupation forces.
Al-Ghul insisted on the unity of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and the West Bank.
We urge the Arin al-Asud resistance group and all freedom fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader Mohammed al-Daif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Hawara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They are certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories. And with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ola Al-Asi, Gaza.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities across the occupied territories, protesting against the Israeli cabinet's judicial reforms. Israeli media estimated 110,000 people demonstrated in Tel Aviv alone. People chanted slogans and waved flags, while some called the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a dictator and his cabinet a fascist one. Mass rallies continue to be held despite Netanyahu putting the controversial reforms on hold, after opponents organized some of the biggest street protests ever witnessed in Tel Aviv and across the occupied territories. Israelis have been holding these rallies for 18 consecutive weeks since the judicial overhaul plan was presented in January. The reforms would give the Israeli cabinet greater control over the judiciary. Critics say that it will remove vital checks and balances and hand unchecked power to the government. Fighting in Sudan enters the fourth week as the warring parties are meeting in Saudi Arabia to hold the first round of direct talks. Khartoum is witnessing intense street battles as the army is pounding targets in the city. Envoys of Sudan's army and paramilitary rapid support forces, also known as the RSF, are now in the Saudi port city of Jeddah for talks. Two sides have reached multiple truces over the past weeks, but none of them have been respected. The truce talks brokered by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia come while the army and the RSF have made it clear that they would only discuss a humanitarian ceasefire. The fighting has derailed an internationally backed plan to usher in civilian rule following years of unrest and uprisings in the African country. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
Moscow will reportedly begin buying foreign currency as early as this month, May, to bolster reserves. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Russia could restart purchases of foreign currency for its reserves in May as growing energy revenues stabilize public finances despite Western efforts to damage the country's economy, Bloomberg reported recently. The finance ministry is due to announce the resumption of foreign exchange purchases later this week, the outlet said. Initial volumes are expected to be equivalent to about $200 million in yuan per month. The Chinese currency is viewed as the main asset Russia can use for transactions to refill its $154 billion, the National Wealth Fund. It will be important for the market that the state is starting to accumulate reserves again instead of spending them, said Natalia Milchakova, an analyst at Freedom Holding Corp, adding this may even positively affect the ruble. Russia halted foreign exchange purchases in late January 2022 and further suspended the program following the outbreak of the conflict in Ukraine. At the beginning of this year, the Bank of Russia resumed operations with foreign currency amid soaring oil and gas revenues. The move was part of a revamped budgetary mechanism designed to shield the economy from volatility of commodity markets, and transactions are now carried out in yuan. Moscow has slashed yuan sales over the past 2 months to cover the budget deficit, with sales halving in April compared to February. The volumes of foreign exchange purchases will initially be small, but will still be highly symbolic, as they will show that Russia is building reserves rather than eating through them, according to Bloomberg's Russia economist Alexander Isakov. The shift from selling to buying would highlight Russia's ability to keep up the flow of petrodollars in the face of sanctions and the price cap imposed by the EU, G7 and their allies, Bloomberg said. Despite an unprecedented deficit, which amounted to 2.4 trillion rubles by the end of the first quarter, the Russian federal budget is on the mend, partly due to changes in the calculations of some oil taxes, Bloomberg reported. Also, Business Insider reported Russia is likely to start buying foreign currency as soon as this month, marking the first time Moscow has replenished the country's reserves since the start of Russia-Ukraine crisis in February 2022. Moscow is likely to snap up around $200 million in Chinese yuan each month, Bloomberg Economics reported recently. The yuan is one of the few key currencies available to Russia after Western sanctions cut the country off from the world's dollar-denominated financial system. Russia stopped buying foreign currency in late January 2022 due to market volatility shortly before the start of Russia-Ukraine crisis. After the crisis, Russia was hit with sweeping Western sanctions and it suspended its currency intervention program. By June, a U.S.-backed global task force had blocked over $300 billion worth of assets held by Russia's central bank. Russia resumed its currency intervention program again in January 2023, starting with the yuan. Russia's impending purchase of the Chinese currency would mark a reversal of its yuan sales from its reserves to cover its budget deficit, which hit $29 billion in the first quarter of 2023. The country has been cutting yuan sales since February, per Bloomberg Economics. Alexander Isakov, Russia economist at Bloomberg Economics, said the volumes of FX purchases will be small initially, but highly symbolic, as they will show that the country, instead of eating through reserves, is building them. Moscow's resumption of foreign currency reserve interventions would indicate that Western sanctions and a G7-led price cap on Russian crude aren't enough to curb Russia's energy revenues. Russia, an energy giant, has managed to maintain its energy revenues even in the face of Western regime sanctions. In large part, the Kremlin has accomplished this by forcing oil producers like Gazprom and Lukoil to pay more taxes, Bloomberg reported. Russia has also been able to counter Western-led restrictions by redirecting oil exports to alternative markets such as China and India. The two Asian countries have been snapping up so much Russian crude that Russia's first quarter seaborne crude exports surpassed levels in the same period last year, according to Kepler, a commodities analytics firm. In April, the International Energy Agency said Moscow's revenue was down about 43% from a year ago, but oil prices have been getting support since early April due to production cuts from OPEC and Russia. On the demand side, China's economic reopening after nearly 3 years of an on-off COVID-19 lockdowns is also expected to give support to prices. U.S. crude oil futures are down 5.8% so far this year to around 76% a barrel, but are up nearly 14% from this year's low of around $67 a barrel. International Brent oil futures are down 7.6% so far this year at around $79.50 a barrel, but are up 9% from this year's low.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we take a look at a story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective for once. Social media has become a huge part of all of our daily lives. Some of the giant brands like Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and others boast hundreds of millions of users or more. But the social media age has as many drawbacks for Muslims as it does benefits. We'll get into that with our studio guests in just a minute. But first, we hit the streets of London this week to ask ordinary Muslims for their views as well.
I grew up on social media. I think I started in 2018. I built a following of 420,000 followers on TikTok. But I got like severely depressed because although you're kind of growing up yourself, you also grow up with other people and you feel like they have a huge impact on your life and you feel like you can't really do anything right. And I feel like having those followers did kind of influence the person that I became. Haram is very normalized, and when you do like halal things, it's not so much normalized. So it was kind of really difficult to find like the perfect balance. But when I stopped like doing certain things on social media, I lost a lot of followers. And I think on my mental health, I just kind of didn't really understand because I thought I did something good. Obviously, I did something good like religiously, but I didn't really understand why people didn't like it. So that's what made me see social media a little bit differently. It made me realize that the people that are supporting you aren't necessarily the people you want to be supporting you. I was literally seeking validation from the creation, not the creator, astaghfirullah. But it's a blessing in disguise, alhamdulillah, because I needed that push, like, to put on my hijab.
I think it can be used for good things most of the time. It just depends on what you follow and who you interact with on social media yourself. I would say for little kids, they get influenced easily. But for me, I usually follow, for example, people that post about their jobs or they post about medicine-related stuff, etc. So it's good for me. For a lot of people, it cannot, whatever's happening in Sudan, a lot of news outlets are not maybe saying a lot of things that you can see on social media because there's a lot of people that are in the situation themselves that are posting about, etc. But most of the time you can find misinformation, a lot of misinformation, and then other people have to come out and say, okay, this is not true. I think it's good because a lot of the times I did not hear about Palestine, etc., what's happening on, like, for example, CNN, BBC, they're not really reporting the truth about it. But on social media, especially TikTok, you keep going on and then the news keeps going, but sometimes it's hard to filter out what is right and what is wrong.
Someone said to me, like, what is your standard of beauty? Like, what do you think beauty is? I was like, I don't know, Kim Kardashian, like, small nose, massive lips. And they were like, no, that's so wrong. And they were like to me, until you see beauty as modesty, you will never see beauty in modesty. And that night I put on the hijab. Yeah. Alhamdulillah. I used to like just do pranks on my parents, and then I gained like 100k in one day because the prank went viral, got like 4 million views. But back in 2019, it was a lot more easier to gain like traction on social media. But now I just do like dawah Islamic content, and alhamdulillah, even though I have less like views, the hasanat is a lot greater in the akhirah, inshallah.
Joining us today to talk about Islam, Muslims and social media, we have two esteemed guests. Paul Williams runs the Blogging Theology social media platform, which has hundreds of thousands of followers. Blogging Theology features a regular cast of high-profile guests discussing Islam mostly, but also other Abrahamic faiths too. And Noor Fekri is a business owner and politics graduate with a keen interest in the Middle East. She has successfully used social media to shine a light on religious and political events in a way that is easily accessible to the everyday person. Welcome to the show, both of you. Paul, you've been on the show before, so I'll come straight to you. Nice to have you back, of course. But just tell me, obviously, you've been on social media a while now. You're quite a well-established brand, especially here in the UK. Tell me about your experience. How have you found it navigating the world of social media?
I think overwhelmingly it's been very positive for me, actually. And in a sense, I'm glad I've come to social media later in life because I bring kind of experience from the real world into social media. So I try and avoid obvious pitfalls like getting into arguments or being sick. So I try and focus on what I do, and I try and do what I do better each day, and rather than getting involved in disputes and arguments, which I have done in the past, mainly at Speaker's Corner, but online, I focus on the work, and alhamdulillah, blessing from God, it's been a very good experience so far.
But surely you've come across some of the negative aspects, yep. The fact that even if you avoid the toxic, like the debates, the arguments, that type of thing, I mean, the fact that you have a large following now, people look to you for information and for knowledge, and they enjoy your content, they'll probably pay you quite a regular bunch of compliments, I dare say, Paul. How have you handled that? Do you think it's changed you in any way?
Yes, that's a very good point, because there can be problems to do with success rather than just bad experiences. So I have had a lot of praise, and that is difficult to deal with. I find it difficult to deal with because that's a test for me in terms of the challenges to be arrogant or egotistical. So I'm very conscious where the blessing has come from, and I try and always remember that comes from God. And also it could disappear at any moment. You know, the plug could be pulled on the channel, or I could get run over by a bus or something. So I'm aware that it's provisional, but it's a blessing. And also it's a service. I see what I do now much more as a service to the ummah rather than an extension of a personal hobby, which is what it was originally. You know, oh, I find this interesting, I'll just do something about it. Now I'm aware that it has that kind of service dimension to it.
Noor, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, first time appearance. Now, just tell me about your experience on social media, because I like the fact that obviously you're young, you're also a sister as well, so your experience is probably quite different to, say, mine or Paul's, who we're used to. I mean, when I first came on social media, it was MySpace. I don't know if you even remember MySpace, MSN, and now it's changed quite a lot to the point where we have TikTok now, brand new platforms, which are a new challenge, which I know you're on as well. Just tell me, what's your experience been like?
So I think my experience is very interesting. I sort of fell into posting videos on social media. It wasn't out of choice. It was more like during my pilgrimage to for the Edebrain, during the Edebrain pilgrimage, I posted a video about my journey, and that sort of went viral. And I think that's what's interesting about TikTok and makes it so different to all the other platforms, is that the algorithm sort of works a little bit differently, and you can go viral quite easily. Mm. And once I gained that following, I think around 20,000 followers, albeit in Baghdad or wherever, but you know, that I then realized that, you know, the power of that and being able to push sort of positive content in terms of my political activism, and I saw that as a fantastic opportunity. So actually, my experience has been very positive. I do. I think it's a little bit different as a woman posting content on social media. You don't necessarily get the compliments that you might get. Instead, you have people asking you to sort of take down your videos, and that women shouldn't be involved in sort of outward political activism and sort of showing your face. Women can sort of use other platforms like writing. But I think it's really important for us to utilise the tools that we have at our disposal, which in this day and age is TikTok, is Instagram Reels, and in terms of me being a woman and sort of showing my face, I believe that it is everyone's Islamic duty to be involved in some sort of social and political activism. I don't think it should be limited in terms of me being a woman.
You said some really interesting stuff there, and what also interested me is what one of the other sisters out in the streets of London mentioned. She said that she went very viral. Mm-hmm. She was getting millions of views, loads of followers. I think it was on TikTok, I can't remember. But she also said that she started to experience depression. Mm-hmm. She felt like she was chasing the creation rather than the creator. Mm-hmm. So she became addicted to getting those views, going viral. She was doing pranks on her parents. Mm-hmm. I think she was from an Arab background, and that's not traditional. To prank your parents is a bit disrespectful, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far there. Yeah. But those seem to be challenges. Mm-hmm. She was initially interested in going viral. Then it started to have a negative effect on her personality, on her life.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that?
I mean, it's a shame that she had to experience that. But it's really easy to fall into those traps, and it's really important for us as Muslims to be aware of that, and be aware that these social media platforms, firstly understand who owns these platforms. So, for example, with Twitter, it's quite recently Elon Musk, and we've got Facebook and Instagram by Mark Zuckerberg. These are all Western either companies or individuals, so they'll have a particular agenda that they're trying to. Being on these social media platforms in and of itself is a challenge for us Muslims. So you're entering essentially the enemy's territory. That is their territory. You're entering it. You need to understand how to navigate it and not fall into the traps of this influencer culture whereby you're entirely consumed by these hijabi influencers that will teach you sort of how to dress modestly whilst simultaneously being modest. It's really important not to fall into that trap.
I'm going to come back to you, Norb, but I want to get Paul before we go on to the next part of the show. Mm-hmm. Paul, I wouldn't be going into an environment which is like a drinking environment, like a pub, for example. You wouldn't see me walking into a pub anymore because obviously I know that there'll be haram activities going on in there. Mm. I'll be in an environment which perhaps I'll be tempted to do something which Islam doesn't condone. So I won't go there. Mm. I'll make the right decision and not bother going there. Mm. With social media, however, it seems as if people are making the decision to go in, knowing that they're going to see haram stuff. They're doing it anyway, and then they try to justify it by saying, well, no, actually, I'm doing something good for Islam. Mm. How can that be justified, Paul?
I think it can be justified. I mean, it's an online public square, so it's not like a pub where you have to specifically go to a specific building. I think, as I say, social media is like an online version of the world, and a lot of us inhabit that. So there's a lot of good online and a lot of evil online, a lot of other just rubbish online as well. Mm. And what I try and do, I try and keep my head down and focus as much as I can, by the grace of God, on producing good content.
It's a bit hard not to do a bit of side-eyeing, though. The zombie scrolling feature, something could pop
maybe it's me, but I don't. Zombie scrolling is just leaves me dead. I mean, pun intended. I mean, 5 seconds and I'm bored. I rush off and grab a book because I'm a bit addicted to books. My addiction, by the way, is not to TikTok, it's to books. And, like I breathe and eat, I have to read. It's just who I am. So I have a different kind of addiction.
To add to this discussion, we spoke with another prominent Muslim social media content producer known by his digital name, That Muslim Guy. That Muslim Guy has gone viral multiple times for his content challenging the anti-Muslim stereotypes routinely peddled by mainstream media. Here's what he had to say on the subject.
So far, I've been on social media for approximately 6 years or so, and it is a mixed bag. Of course, as with everything, social media is a very powerful tool, and I compare it to being the printing press of our day and age. And it's like any other tool, any other technology. It's all about how you use it. It could be used to cause good, could be used to cause harm. And for it's been a net positive, but it has come with a lot of challenges, and we have to learn how to manage the challenges and put controls in place in order to turn it into a net positive and not fall victim to the many cons that are associated with social media. So just to be clear, whenever we talk about addiction, addiction is anything that essentially it's very difficult to stop. It's impacting your life in a negative manner, maybe those around you, and social media is definitely an addiction, whether we like to admit it or not. At the end of the day, no matter how much we try to keep our youth away from social media, like Instagram and Facebook, although youth aren't really using Facebook as much, Instagram, TikTok, no matter what we do, they're going to go to school, they're going to go to work, they're going to go to university, they're going to go wherever, see their friends, and they'll be exposed to it. So the best we could do is to ensure that we educate the youth, our children, the next generation, as to the pros and the cons of media. And there are many dangers. There are pros, but there are many dangers. So the key is education, giving them an Islamic education. Know that there is a lot of haram on these social media platforms. At what age do you allow them to use social media? Now that comes down to the individual parents. Personally, I say the youth are on there anyways. And if we do not go on there as well to counter that narrative, that agenda, whether it's the nudity, whether it's the sexual content, whether it's the Islamophobia being spread on those platforms, if we don't have a presence there, then we can't reclaim the narrative in any way, shape, or form. And the youth that's already on there and we can't do anything about it, they're just going to be exposed to all that negativity and none of the activity. So at the very end of the day, it comes down to your individual intentions, of course, but if you want to do da'wah, you have to use the printing press of today's day and age. Personally, I think this can be divided into two main things. There's the people who achieve great success, and they get all the likes, all the engagements and everything, and then that becomes an addiction, and you want more of it. So then you start off initially talking about Islamic content, and the intentions are righteous, and then you fall victim to this, I need more likes, I need more views, and you start going down that path, essentially, whereby it's just about the views at this point, doesn't matter what I talk about, and you unfortunately move away from your deen, and you fall into depression, and you fall victim to that lifestyle. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, and that's when you're not getting the views. There's no instant fame. It's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years of hard work, you're grinding, and nothing, 20 views, 50 views, 3 likes. What am I even doing this for? And then that's a struggle in and of itself. And you also fall into some sort of depression there. Is this even worth it? So the point becomes, go back to your intentions. And the results are with Allah. And the main thing I can compare that to is, look at prophets and messengers. Like Nuh alayhi salam, Prophet Noah, peace be upon him. How many years, 950 years, he preached to his people? And how many followers did he have? Scholars differ on the number, but it's very, very little. Does that mean he wasn't a great prophet? Does that mean he didn't work as hard as he can to preach his people? No. We control our work, our intention. Allah controls the results. So always remember your intention when you are experiencing either this fame or this seemingly you're not going anywhere. And what's the point?
Well, you've heard from Muhammad there, and let's come back to our discussion in the studio. Now, Noor, I'm going to come back to you because I want to tell you very briefly a story which I saw very recently on social media. It happened on Twitter. There was a sister who posted an Eid Day celebration picture of herself. Now, I didn't see the picture. I think that she was young, good-looking sister, mashallah, and unfortunately, she began to get trolled. She was trolled routinely. There was inappropriate comments being made by non-Muslims about her. The picture went viral. Then she started getting attacked from Muslims who were like, how dare she put a picture up, look what's happened. She's now being shamed and embarrassed and disgraced. She then ended up deleting her profile, deleting the picture. She's now disappeared from social media completely. I assume that's she's had an awful experience, I can only imagine. Mm. So just that's an example of where social media has gone wrong, very badly wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a risk that even you're making, surely, by just being on there. Mm-hmm. A day could come where something happens which puts you in the spotlight, you could go viral for something negative, mm-hmm. you could say something wrong, and then there you go, you're in trouble. So just tell me, how again do you feel that we as Muslim sisters can handle this type of danger?
I think we need to be really calculated in our approach. So when we're entering these spaces, again, like I said, we're entering the enemy's territory. So, you know, not posting just any random content, not falling into the traps of posting images, you know, to feed into that sort of capitalist ideology, you know. We had numerous sort of hijabi influencers that were the algorithm would push them so far, and it would get so many followers for sort of, you know, promoting hijabi modest streetwear. And then they proceeded to remove their hijab, you know, a couple of years later. And in turn, a lot of women then also removed their hijab.
Do you think that that was social media that led them to that decision? Would you blame social media for that?
Yeah, I mean, there was an obvious trend. There was an obvious wave of these social media influencers removing their hijab all at the same time. So I do believe that social media had a massive role to play in that. But also, it's interesting because there's a massive double standard here. So the West will sort of push that kind of content whilst at the same time demonizing Muslims on, for example, mainstream media outlets.
So this is what I would say then, potentially. I could say that social media is not a safe space for my daughters, it's not a safe space for you. You shouldn't be on there. You could get drawn into a negative worldview. You could end up removing your hijab. Yeah. What would you say to that?
So I would say that, unfortunately, this is our reality. So we, as Muslims, we shouldn't sort of run away from our reality. Social media is the reality now. Mm-hmm. And there's no use in us sort of hiding away and sort of trying not to be involved in this reality. Instead, we should try and utilize the tools at our disposal to try and to be a force for good on social media, rather than sort of shying away from being involved out of fear. You know, and whether we like it or not, we have to be involved. So it's a matter of sort of as well establishing putting in guidelines as to how we should be involved and sort of educating each other within our communities and also recognizing talent within our communities. We've some people that sort of can put together a fantastic essay within 20 minutes, and then you've got others that can articulate themselves really well in a 1 minute TikTok video, and being able to sort of support each other into the right avenues, and also not really idealizing a particular person, like a particular activist, and making them a celebrity, so that when they do get attacked or taken down or deplatformed or silenced, that the whole movement stops. Instead, we should mobilise and sort of do, you know, it should be a movement that is done all together.
That is a very good point you mentioned. I'm going to throw that at Paul, actually. The fact that there are big egos now that are built up. I'll admit, I'm a bit of an addict. I'm a social media addict. I'm not afraid to say it. I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm even on TikTok and YouTube. You know, it's hard not to be these days, as I think Noor mentioned in her point. But it's very difficult not to become a bit of a narcissist. Obviously, I'll be receiving compliments. My ego's going to grow. I'm going to get a big head from all this. And I think that there is a legitimate issue here of people going online with good intentions, maybe doing a bit of dawah activism, that type of thing, and then all of a sudden they become these big personalities. They're like celebrities. They get treated differently. They start to act differently. I've seen this happen many, many times. Tell me, Paul, how dangerous is this?
It's a real danger. I mean, the Quran talks about life being a test, and there are different kinds of tests, and this is a test for us who are on social media, who achieve some measure of success. And that is how to deal with that in terms of vanity and egotism and so on. And absolutely, I'm acutely aware of that. And I have a little motto on my screen, but it partly involves, you know, remembering to be humble, remembering where success comes from, remembering where my money comes from, where everything comes from. It's not coming out of my own cleverness. It's a gift from God. It's all from God. So it's a challenge to being Muslim, actually, a good Muslim.
It is a challenge. But what worries me is that there are a lot of people online now that are doing dawah. They're trying to represent Islam, and they're self-styling themselves as ambassadors for the religion. And we don't know where these people have been educated. We don't know if they're qualified to do so. They start lecturing others on how to behave them. Sometimes it turns out that they're not behaving as they lecture people in their own private lives. So do you think that perhaps some of this activism online is actually doing more damage than
absolutely
good?
There's an awful lot of toxic egotism going on. I think I can only say is find reliable sources of information, reliable scholars or reputable people like Hamza Zoltzer, so I can sort of drop names, and Sapiens Institute. Follow reliable, acknowledged people who've got a track record of being mainstream normative Muslims, and follow them and follow their advice about what books to read and who else to listen to. So don't go running off on your own, and, you know, follow the mainstream and look to the mainstream scholars and people like Hamza Zoltzer, and I don't think you'll go wrong then.
Noor, I want to ask you a bit about challenges the Muslims will find, not just for themselves dealing with the platform, but also the fact that there's like a lot of Islamophobic content out there. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of anti-Muslim stories that will go much more viral, be shared a lot more than, say, positive stories about Muslims. So in a way, I guess you could argue that Muslims need to be online, to combat this anti-Muslim trend. But do you think that it's actually an effective way of fighting back?
I do think it is an effective way of fighting back. I mean, if we compare it to previously, we only sort of had mainstream media outlets, and that was the only option available. Whereas now social media can kind of be seen as a more level ground, and we can all engage, and we can all have a platform, albeit, of course, with, you know, despite it being owned by Western sort of either companies or individuals, they're always going to have the upper hand. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in these platforms altogether. I mean, we've seen some real tangible change on the ground happening through these social media sort of campaigns. We've had the Safe Sheikh Jarrah campaign that happened, for example, whereby there was a Twitter storm and everyone sort of contributed to that. And although, I mean, and at the time the expulsions were halted, and although that might not be the, you know, a huge political event, it's not like we liberated Palestine, for example, but you can see how that can actually, you know, our involvement in social media can actually have real tangible change on the ground. And as well, like I said, there's a massive double standard in that, you know, they'll push content that sort of feeds into that capitalist ideology, whereas, you know, they'll demonize Muslims on mainstream media and sort of, you know, show us images of terrorists and ISIS and sort of associate that with Muslims to try and dehumanize them and then justify, you know, invading their countries, for example. So, yeah, it's a tool at our disposal that we should be making use of without falling into the traps.
I know from my own personal experience that I tend not to look at the views. You know, I think people get obsessed with views. They make clickbait content. They start to get accused of acting a certain way because they're trying to get people to watch. I just produce it. Do I like it?
Yes.
That's good enough for me.
Don't
look at the views. Yes. Just post your content. If you've got something interesting to say, put it out there.
Exactly.
That's it. Just don't focus on that.
Exactly.
And hopefully you'll have a better experience, inshallah. Well, thank you very much to both of you. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you to our guests. And for you at home, join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.